From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Biden is traveling this week campaigning for his nearly $2 trillion economic relief package. And he's in Wisconsin today appealing directly to voters at a CNN town hall before heading to Michigan. Meanwhile, in Washington, Democrats are planning to push through the bill without any congressional Republican support. Let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. She joins us now. Hey, Tam.
Hey.
So White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked today about why the president is visiting a swing state. And here's what he said.
The president felt that he could have a good conversation with people about the path forward and also even people who disagree with him. So it was not more complicated than that.
Okay, Tam, is it really that simple?
He just wants to go to a state that was pivotal to his win in 2020 to talk to people, a state that has a likely very contentious Senate race in 2022 with Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican, up for re-election. He had a difficult, challenging, tight re-election last time. So, you know, it could be that simple. That he just wanted to go to the middle of the country to talk to people, as one White House official put it to me. But there are lots of reasons to visit Wisconsin politically.
Yeah, politically. Absolutely. You know, the White House also announced an increase in coronavirus doses sent to states this week. What does this tell you about how Biden's vaccination rollout is going right now?
Yeah, what they're saying is that with this new bump up in the number of doses going out, the amount of doses being sent out to states has increased more than 50% since he took office. In addition, they announced that the number of vaccine doses going to local pharmacies, this is above and beyond the doses going to states, that that is going from 1 million doses a week to 2 million doses a week. Now, we knew that the number of doses available was going to slowly increase. It's not clear exactly what the Biden administration has done to make this happen or whether they've sped it up. Jen Psaki said that President Biden owns this pandemic, that he has only been in office a month, but he is working this hard because he knows how important it is. Then she also said, and the Trump administration left us with an empty cupboard and had states out on their own trying to figure this out. So they are, in a way, trying to have it both ways, saying they own this, they want to make it happen, but also, like, blaming the guy before them, which is a time-honored tradition in presidential politics.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about this relief bill. It has the support of some Republican mayors and governors and even voters, but it's overwhelmingly opposed by congressional Republicans. How is Biden approaching this situation in Congress?
And I've spoken with some of these mayors, and the mayors and governors came and met with the president last week at the White House. And the amount of emphasis that the White House is putting on the support they have from state and local officials is an indication that they don't have congressional Republicans that they can point to as being on their team. So Biden's legislative affairs team is working this. They are still talking to Republicans, even though they don't anticipate overwhelming Republican support. And the other thing they have to worry about, though, is also keeping all of the Democrats in line, because they have the narrowest of margins in the House and the Senate. They want to use a procedure that requires, you know, 50 plus one in the Senate, and they need to keep everyone in line.
Okay, so should this relief bill pass, I mean, Democrats are already talking about using GOP opposition to the bill against Republicans in the 2022 midterms. Is the GOP at all worried about that?
If they were worried about it, they aren't really showing it. From the GOP perspective, certainly they feel like they have things to run on in 2022, including complaining about the schools not being reopened to the satisfaction of many parents and blaming the Biden administration for that. They have a lot they're going to talk about. It's not clear whether they'll be trying to talk about this COVID relief bill. And if they do, I bet you will hear words like a $1.9 billion bailout of Democratic priorities. Republicans will find a way to campaign against it.
That's NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, as always. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to get more reaction now from a powerful teachers union on the latest CDC guidelines to reopen schools. The guidelines came out last Friday and include social distancing, masking, and weekly COVID testing for all staff. Notably, the CDC says vaccinating teachers is not required for schools to reopen, and that has been a flashpoint for teachers' unions. Joining us now is Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, the largest educators' union in the country. Becky, welcome, and what's your position? Should teachers be vaccinated before reopening schools?
Here's the reality. For 11 months now, educators, parents, and students have been waiting for the federal government to step up and do their job and provide us with the resources so that we can reopen our school buildings safely and equitably. We have yet to get those resources. So they rightly are wanting that extra layer of protection for vaccines. But also, I will point out, the director of the CDC, Dr. Walensky, talked about prioritizing educators in getting the vaccine. Right now, we only have 25 states that have prioritized educators.
What's the consequence of that? Because where I live in Arizona, teachers are getting vaccinated. We checked in with teachers in Ohio 2 weeks ago. They were just getting vaccinated, and they were thrilled. And yet, as you say, many states, they're not yet on the list. What's the result of a patchwork like that?
For the CDC to actually say in the guidelines that teachers should be prioritized, of course, President Biden has been calling for that as well, and we continue to advocate for that. So we're hopeful that together we will be able to get those other states to prioritize educators. And the other thing that we're very hopeful around the president's plan is that he not only is working directly with state departments of health and state departments of education to distribute the vaccine in a much more organized and effective way and equitably, and that's a real important part of the plan. But also he is working really, really hard to increase the production so that as we get to that level, that 1B level for educators, that we actually have the vaccine to give them.
Becky, I know you're aware that there are scientific studies that say schools that have reopened have not contributed to major problems with the virus, even though it might be raging in the community or widespread in the community. What is your take on that? Is that not reason enough, information enough, to get almost all schools back reopened?
So I'm glad you brought that up, Peter. When we talked with CDC about that, but one of the things we asked them was, what communities have you gotten studies from? Have you done those in-depth studies in all the different diverse communities that our students go to school in? And they did acknowledge that they had not done studies in all of those areas. And one of the areas that we're most concerned about are very densely populated urban areas where we know we have issues of equity and access. We know that this pandemic has disproportionately impacted Black and brown and indigenous communities. We already know that. And all of the crises it's spawned, the economic crisis, the healthcare crisis, and they are also more likely, Peter, to go to those buildings that have been crumbling, where we have not, as a country, taken on school modernization, which we've been fighting for decades. We need to have the kind of deep research done in those areas. And the CDC has indicated to us that they are going to continue those studies.
I see.
We cannot take one piece of it and not all the other pieces to keep our students safe.
I've spoken with many teachers in the past year who are very concerned that their students are falling far behind because of all of the remote learning that's happening. They're not with their classmates. They're not in the classroom. Some districts now are considering extending the school year into the summer. What are you hearing about that? Do you support something like that?
We have to think about this in a more comprehensive way. How do we extend the learning, not only through the summer, but throughout the next year or couple of years? How do we do the kind of intense work that we know we have to do academically? And how do we address the mental health issues, the social-emotional growth, students not being together, students not being with adults as they're learning? How do we address those things too? So we're thinking about it holistically. We're reaching out and partnering with other organizations. We're bringing groups of educators together with parents and mental health experts to actually put together a plan of action that will begin to bridge those gaps that we know exist.
All right. And in September and August of this fall, when the next school year starts, where will we be? Do you expect most schools in this country to be open for in-person learning?
So it's hard to predict that. But if we do this, if we continue to follow the science and work as the community that we need to work together as, then I absolutely believe that we can reopen our schools to in-person learning. We can keep them open safely, and we can learn from this year and address those deep-seated societal inequities in a way that actually will make sure that every one of our students has what they need and they deserve.
Becky Pringle is president of the National Education Association. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Peter.
What is the future of the Republican Party? Our next guest says, before answering that question, the GOP has to redefine itself as a governing party with ambitions beyond a single leader. But is it possible, after just 7 Republican senators voted to convict former President Donald Trump in his second impeachment trial? Lonhee Chin is a fellow at the Hoover Institution. He also advised Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign, and he joins us now for more. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanya.
Lonhee, most Republicans stuck by Trump in that vote, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, even though he blasted Trump in a speech afterwards. What did you take away from that trial about the future of the party?
Well, it is going to be a tumultuous short term for sure. Obviously, former President Trump still has a significant amount of currency within the Republican Party and within the conservative movement. And I think the question now, in at least the short to intermediate term, is to what degree that influence will be mitigated by the passage of time, by reflection upon what happened on January the 6th in those Capitol riots. And then in the longer term, there's a question about the issues and the ways in which the party can be a governing coalition again, can be a party that many Americans look to provide an alternative vision of governance to the one that we're seeing in office today.
Okay, and you actually say in the past, when the conservative movement has been the most successful, it's because it's been a party of ideas. But a new poll from Politico Morning Consult actually shows that 59% of Republican voters said they wanted Trump to play a major role in their party going forward, and that's actually up 18 percentage points from a poll taken on January 7th, right after the insurrection. In light of this, do voters agree with your thoughts on the direction of the party?
Well, I think some do. Clearly, though, some are very fond of the former president still. There are some in the party, perhaps even a majority of the party, who believe that former President Trump ought to be at the center of Republican politics going forward. And others, myself included, would like the conservative movement and the Republican Party to think more about what it is that it will do and will stand for as a party in governance. And I think the more durable approach in the long run is to have, again, a party and a movement that's focused on ideas rather than personalities.
On this idea of being a party of ideas, what issues do you want to see the party focused on?
Well, I think there are a series of issues where the party needs to articulate a little bit more clearly exactly what it plans to do. So, you know, one issue that a lot of people have addressed concern on is the question of economic mobility and how we can create a more upwardly mobile society. Another area is healthcare. For a long time, the Republican Party and conservatives were associated only with opposition to the Affordable Care Act. Going forward, what are some ways that conservatives can articulate a market-based approach to healthcare reform that is durable? And then a third area where I think the conservative movement has to get a little sharper is in areas that are much more controversial internally. So immigration and climate change. The party has to express some points of view to try to tackle these challenges with these problems. And so far, at least, we haven't heard too much in the way of solutions. Yeah, only rhetoric, not solutions.
South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham was asked on Fox News Sunday about Donald Trump's future with the Republican Party. Let's listen.
Donald Trump is the most vibrant member of the Republican Party. The Trump movement is alive and well. People believe that he brought change to Washington. Policy-wise, it was long overdue.
Graham also said that he supported the former president's daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, if she decides to run for Senate. Many Republicans who are in office right now see a future of the party more aligned with Donald Trump more generally, which includes Trump's children. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think we have to separate out some of what we heard from Senator Graham. I mean, first of all, on the policy side of things, there are unquestionably a few issues where Donald Trump brought up divisions or questioned orthodoxies that very much need to be questioned. And those are conversations we need to have, whether it's in areas like trade or the U.S. relationship with China. Trump's influence from a policy perspective is something that we'll need to tease out. But in terms of members of the Trump family or others who might be closely affiliated with Trump running for public office, I think that they'll need to participate in these debates like everybody else, and we'll see where things come out. I think it's difficult to prejudge one candidate or another, except to say that those who endorse the idea of having a vision-based Republican Party in the future, as opposed to one that's personality-based, that'd be what I would support. And so as we approach the midterm elections in 2022, we'll see how it all sorts out.
You've been a Republican for a long time. You've been studying this, thinking deeply about this, advising Republicans. Are you hopeful? Where do you see this going in the next 2 years? Do you think the fight is going to get more nasty, or do you actually see a future where the party unites?
It's possible the fight gets more nasty. It's possible that things turn negatively before they turn positively. But in the long run, I am optimistic. I am hopeful that we'll have a viable conservative movement that's a counterweight to the progressivism we're seeing in many parts of the country. I am confident that will happen. When it will happen, I can't tell you. But I do think once this debate happens and we do have this contrast, it is something where the conservative movement comes out stronger at the end of the day. And I'm hopeful for that outcome.
Lanhee Chen is a fellow at the Hoover Institution and a Republican policy advisor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been nearly a year since the pandemic forced many of us to spend more time at home than ever before. Some have taken up bread making, others are learning to knit or to play an instrument. And then there are people who have started their own podcasts. Michaela Lafrak of member station WAMU introduces us to a few of them.
Last March, when the pandemic hit, Sam Lee of Tyson's Corner, Virginia, and his two sons suddenly had a lot of time on their hands.
We're stuck at home. What are we going to do?
One day, he threw out an idea. Let's all make a podcast. His 10-year-old said, no way. But his 7, now 8-year-old Logan was into it. They launched a weekly show called Social Distancing with Pops.
I'm Daddy. And this is
Logan.
And it's been made very clear to me that I'm the co-host and the main host is Logan.
Lee is one of many people who have launched amateur COVID-era podcasts. Unlike professional podcasters, their goal isn't to make money or gain a wide listenership. Rather, it's to pursue a creative passion or just document what's going on around them. Sam and Logan Lee's conversations started out simple.
What's it been like so far, being stuck at home?
I like it.
And why do you like it?
Because it's fun staying at home because I don't like school.
But soon, they started taking on heavier topics, like the racism their Asian American family was suddenly experiencing after then-President Trump falsely blamed the coronavirus on China.
You know, even in our experience, we'd be walking around our neighborhood and some people would be yelling at us to go back home. And we're like, well, we're not Chinese. And it gave us a way to kind of talk through what it meant to be Asian American in the time of COVID. I didn't expect that we'd be able to talk about topics like that in such depth.
Other new podcasters are addressing pandemic-related challenges like unemployment. Catholic University theater students Brandon Horwin and Sophie Williams make a podcast called Whatcha Doin'. They interview actors, playwrights, and composers about their careers and how they're making a living during the pandemic. In one episode, they interview Broadway actor John Breckenridge.
What advice do you have for young artists and students for this time?
You know what? I think, Brandon, is that you have got to create your own career.
Here's Williams.
We did have questions for theater professionals, like, what are we going to do? What are you doing? You know, how was that working out for you? It's a really tumultuous time for everyone, but particularly people that are, you know, trying to go out into the workforce right now.
For the hosts, it's a creative exercise and a way to get answers to career questions for themselves and their peers. For other local podcasters, the platform is a way to share information without meeting in person. Isidro Quintanilla is a legal assistant at Carecen, an advocacy and aid organization for Latinos in the D.C. area. A few months back, he approached his colleague Juan Misledona about launching their own show.
Why we don't have like a radio? We can find the way that some people can hear us.
They launched a Spanish language podcast called Radio Carecen DC.
Muy buenos días. Bienvenidos nuevamente a su
They cover news from Central and South America, local aid services, and immigration updates, like this recent segment about President Joe Biden's immigration policies.
Prácticamente un programa muy informativo, Juan.
Sí, efectivamente, el presidente Biden ha impulsado...
Quintanilla says he also wanted to prioritize cultural conversations. In one show, they discuss how different Latin American cultures celebrate major holidays.
We try to give good news about immigration, about another topic that people can for a minute forget what is happening in the world.
The hosts are still trying to figure out the best way to reach their local community of working class Salvadorans while figuring out the mechanics of making a podcast at the same time. The challenges of producing led Sam Lee and his son to put a pause on their show last summer. Lee says it took a ton of his time to edit and produce it.
It's a limited run podcast with a limited listenership, but I really like that. It's a bit of a time capsule for us that way.
While they'll always have this audio time capsule, they've also gained something else. Lee says sitting down every week to talk and ask each other personal questions forever strengthened his relationship with his youngest son. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lafrac.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from HomeTap, the smart way to access your home's equity and pay for life's expenses without a loan. With HomeTap, receive cash in as little as 3 weeks and use it for anything you'd like, from paying off debt to funding renovations and more. Plus, you don't have to deal with monthly payments or interest. Learn more about HomeTap and get a personalized estimate at HomeTap.com.
There is so much Black excellence in the sciences that we want to celebrate. So in honor of Black History Month, all this week, Shortwave is featuring conversations with Black scientists and educators, people doing incredible work and pushing for a world where science serves everyone. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
Fast food and other service industry workers are striking today to demand a $15 an hour federal minimum wage. The protests in honor of Black History Month are taking place in 15 cities as Congress prepares to debate raising the minimum wage in the new coronavirus relief package. Let's bring in NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley for more on this story. Hey, Scott.
Good to be with you.
Yes. So Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi says the $15 minimum wage hike will be included in the House's version of the relief bill. But President Biden has expressed doubt that it would make it into the package in the end. What kind of opposition do you think it will face in the Senate?
It faces both a procedural challenge and then a political challenge. The procedural challenge is the legislative workaround Democrats hope to use to sidestep a Republican filibuster can only be used for certain budget-related measures, and it's not entirely clear whether a minimum wage increase would meet that test. Certainly, raising the minimum wage would affect the federal budget. It would raise the cost of Medicare, for example, since low-wage nursing aides would make more. It would also reduce demand for food stamps, but it's still not clear whether it meets that so-called birdbath test. If it survives that, though, it still faces a political challenge because Dems have such a small majority. I mean, it's a 50-50 right. Senate, basically. They can't afford to lose a single of their own members' votes. And there are some centrist Democrats who've expressed doubts about a minimum wage increase of this size. So it really could come down to whether, you know, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin or Montana Senator John Tester is willing to go along.
Okay. So the Congressional Budget Office published this report last week on raising the minimum wage that's drawing a lot of criticism from economists who say some of the findings were wrongly inflated. What did the report say, and why is it facing this criticism?
Well, the congressional bean counters forecast that boosting the wage to $15 by 2025 would boost pay directly for 17 million workers and indirectly for as many as 10 million more. But they also said it would cost about 1.4 million jobs. And that's, you know, the traditional trade-off we think of is that a lot of minimum wage workers are better off because they're making more money. Some lose their jobs, though, because employers decide they can't afford to pay that. They cut back hours or they switch to automation or whatnot. Now, the Congressional Budget Office admits there's considerable uncertainty around that forecast, so you can certainly argue with the numbers. But it is true that hiking the minimum wage is not a completely free lunch. There would presumably be some workers who would lose their jobs, and then it becomes a policy question of whether the benefits for the higher pay for the many is enough to offset the cost of the lost job for the few.
Right. I have less than a minute with you, but I want to ask you about this larger question. Biden has made raising the minimum wage to a higher level in some way a key part of his plan to narrow the racial wealth gap. What role does the minimum wage actually play in reaching that goal?
Well, African-American workers, for example, are more likely to make minimum wage than white workers. 38% of African-American workers compared to 23% of white workers who would benefit from that wage hike. So it's certainly a piece of the president's plan to address racial imbalance.
NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley, as always, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
In 2012, freelance journalist Theo Padnos was in a Turkish border town looking for a way into Syria to cover the civil war. The men who volunteered to guide him through the country were not who they said they were. Once over the border into Syria, they kidnapped him, tortured him, moved him from prison to prison for 2 years, and threatened Padnos with execution. He survived, and now he's written Blindfold, a memoir of his captivity, and he joins me now. Theo, welcome, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, but after reading your book, it does seem like you went into this war zone unprepared. You were on your own. You had no support from a news organization, no assignments. At what point did you realize that these men who were supposed to be helping you were actually members of an Al-Qaeda affiliate and meant you great harm?
I personally did not realize until they put the gun to my head. I make a point of this in the book. I underline my blindness and when I could see how little, in fact, I was seeing. And once they put the blindfold on me, then I began to understand. So this is the paradox of seeing in an Islamic State, is that every citizen there, all the young recruits in the jihad, every normal, average, everyday citizen who submits to that kind of government, and of course the prisoners, you deprive yourself of your senses, your sense of orientation in the world, your own identity. You lose all of that. And for me, it was a physical blindness and a period of extended terror. You're meant to awaken with a deeper and truer and more profound, more moral orientation in life. And I think that happened to me. Of course, I, who at first thought the rebels were possibly a force for good, I woke up with a deeper and truer orientation, knowing that they are evil and wicked. But most people who go through these experiences of a prison in an Islamic State, even the prisoners, the poor prisoners they abuse so horribly, wake up loving these guys.
Something like a Stockholm syndrome.
I don't know if it's Stockholm syndrome. You call it brainwashing. Perhaps it is Stockholm syndrome, although at a certain point, 8 million citizens of Iraq and Syria were under the control of these people. Not all of them were victims of Stockholm syndrome.
But you, Theo, you were tortured. You were beaten terribly so. Did you think that eventually you were going to be executed? I mean, what did you think they had in store for you?
Of course. I made a calendar on my wall maybe in the first week or something. It was October of 2012. And I'm like, why should I even bother with November? I'm going to be dead by then. So I didn't do a November. But then November came along. I'm like, all right, I'll do till Thanksgiving. And you know, the point of an Islamic prison in an Islamic State today is to make you leave the world of this life. So they what they do is they subject you to a near-death experience in prison.
Theo, your kidnappers were seeking an Islamic State, but they were not the Islamic State. I wonder if you can help explain the political situation in Syria at the time of your captivity. You were captured by an Al-Qaeda affiliate that were actually at war with the Islamic State. What was going on?
When I first arrived in Syria in October of 2012, there was one large resistance movement against the government of President Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. So there were many factions in this movement. There were some that were like more Islamist flavored and some that said that we want a secular government over this country and people can choose their own religions. Relatively early on, the fundamentalists, the people with the most moral authority on the ground in that country, they took power over everybody else. And within the rebellion, there was a split, which occurred while I was in prison, in which one half of the fundamentalists called themselves the Islamic State. The other half said, we're going to be Jabhat al-Nusra, it means the victory front. You know, one group of fundamentalists went one way, they called themselves ISIS. Mm. Another group went another way, they said, we're going to call ourselves Al-Qaeda. It was really a branding exercise. They believed in exactly the same things. There was no difference in aims or anything. They both dreamed of a beautiful Islamic golden time for Syria and then for the whole world. I was a prisoner of one half of this fundamentalist movement. And at one point, the top guys in my group said, let's go make war on the other group. And they fought each other for a little while, and they're pretty much friends again.
How did you consider God while you were in captivity? Because you were often surrounded by men of deep faith that was driving them to do what they did to you.
In the beginning, I was terrified by Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. And I felt that it was a summons to the evil within these people around me. And I just, Friday afternoons when they have their big prayer, it terrified me. I just felt that Islam was making life more dangerous for me because it was telling everybody to die. So you ask how I felt about God. I certainly didn't become religious, but I want peace for everybody. I have no resentment against Muslims, but I do think that religion can be ill-used against its own practitioners, the people for whom it brings normally bring comfort and solace, and it can quickly be corrupted and make them do crazy things.
Well, you did not find God, I guess, in prison, but it seems like one of your fellow prisoners at least tried to, or at least made a front of trying to. Matt Schreier, the American photojournalist, converted to Islam, hoping that it would help him get released. But you never did that. Why?
I was afraid that they were going to accuse me of bad faith if I said, yes, yes, I believe, and then they would find out that I wasn't praying regularly, or they would notice that I wasn't that into the prayer. So I was afraid that they were going to discover that I was lying about the religion and, of course, kill me for that. But also, I did not want to convert until they had the gun on my head or the knife at my throat, and then I could say, fine, la ilaha illallah, there is no God but God, wa Muhammadan Rasulullah. If you say that, then technically you're a Muslim, and I could say, fine, I'm with you guys now, don't kill me. But it was like my last get-out-of-jail-free card or get-out-of-execution-free card, and I wasn't going to play it until they made me play it, and they never actually made me play it.
Yeah, Theo, you were in a class of people who were not anywhere near as lucky as you. Five people who were kidnapped in Syria around the same time, James Foley, Kayla Mueller, Peter Kasig, Austin Tice, and you. The first three were killed. We still don't know what happened to Austin Tice, and I wonder if you just sometimes reflect on how in the world you were the one to make it out alive.
I know why I made it out alive. What happened was when the ISIS men decided to form their own little group, they took their own prisoners from our prison, and that was with James Foley and a few of the European hostages. Jabhat al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda people took their prisoners and went the other direction. They had a little divorce, and the reason why I survived is because Jabhat al-Nusra eventually lost a war that they were having with ISIS, and they needed cash, so they bartered me for cash. Wow. ISIS at the time was flush with cash. They didn't need the money. They wanted a big media hit. They were making these very captivating films, and they were discovering what a drug social media can be. So the reason why I survived was because, out of sheer luck, the commanders decided to give certain prisoners to Al-Qaeda, and other prisoners went to ISIS.
And you were there watching as James Foley was murdered on one of those videos, and you were in the captivity of these men, or
yeah,
at least their sympathizers. That must
have
been
right.
Horrendous for you.
I looked at the crawl, and the crawl said, American journalists executed in Syria. I read that and I'm like, wait, I'm the American journalist prisoner in Syria and I'm not being, what's going on? And I was not aware, of course, at the time that there were other American journalist prisoners in Syria. But the first time I became aware of it, yeah, was when I saw James Foley on TV. And there was these bunch of, there was like a bunch of very crazy, psychotic murderers and killers who had already killed tons of people for useless, stupid, idiotic reasons in the room behind me. And I knew these people well. And I changed the channel. I'm like, I don't want to give these lunatics bad ideas. But happily, by that time, the chief al-Qaeda guy had already was already in touch with Qatar, who eventually ransomed me out of Syria.
The ending of your book is very powerful. You describe your release and what it felt like. You wanted to live so badly, but this terrible thing that happened to you is now 6 years or more in the past. How are you doing? Do you feel whole? Do you feel okay?
Yes, I feel very... I'm delighted to be alive. I'm delighted that I have a... you know, a beautiful place to live. I have a lovely partner. I have a beautiful dog and kitty cat and can ski and play tennis and hockey and live a life. I'm happy to be alive. But I, to the extent that I am frustrated and bitter, which I am on behalf of the people of Syria and all my fellow prisoners who I feel have been so mistreated by the world. And I really would like to be able to give something back to those people who helped me so much in my hour of need. My fellow prisoners and their families. And a lot of these people have disappeared, and it would be nice if we could find some information about what happened to them.
Theo Padnos, the book is called Blindfold, a memoir of capture, torture, and enlightenment. Theo, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me.
Today is Mardi Gras, which means any other year except for this one, more than a million people would already have traveled to New Orleans to eat great food, dance down Bourbon Street, and marvel at larger-than-life parade floats. Of course, that's all canceled this year, but Mardi Gras is not dead. People in New Orleans are giving it a different kind of life that adheres to social distancing protocols of this pandemic. And one way is by transforming front porches into parade floats with themes and everything. Staycation is the theme in Judy Walker's neighborhood. She's a retired food editor for the Times-Picayune and writes a column for The Advocate, and she joins us now with more on how we can also celebrate from the comfort of our homes. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tanya. Happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Mardi Gras to you. So Yardi Gras is what you guys are calling what you're doing this year.
Yes, Yardi Gras.
This idea spread like wildfire among folks there in New Orleans. Tell us a little bit more about the staycation theme setup that you and your husband have built.
Well, people here are super, super creative. And I think one reason this went so crazy is because people poured the energy that they would normally put into making costumes into their house floats.
Yeah.
And so we got a pandemic pet. We got a cat in May, and her name is Queso. Her Instagram account is El Gato Queso.
She has an Instagram.
Because we got her the day before Cinco de Mayo. So anyway, she's a ginger tabby, and we were inspired to do a float that is a salute to our staycation companions. And we don't have a porch, okay? We don't have a front porch. So my husband built this incredible plywood thing and painted it to kind of look like the stripes on a tabby cat and like a float. And he used a flat black background, and we put big pictures of our cat on that. And our neighbors and friends sent us pictures of their cats and dogs, and I wrote their name on them, and they are stapled all over our float.
Well, you know what? We're going to have photos of your home and some of the others at hereandnow.org. You know, part of the joy of Mardi Gras is the throws, the items that people on the floats throw to the crowds. And most popular, of course, are the beads. How are you doing it this year?
Well, in the past few years, there's been a trend towards handmade throws. I am a quilter, and I had tons of scrap fabric, so I just started making cat heads and stuffing them with polyester fiberfill. So I'm giving out those, and then I have some little cat sequin headbands, and then I have milk bones for dogs.
You all are holding nothing back. You're really leaning into this whole theme. I love it.
Oh, yeah. And there's great stuff all over town.
Yeah. As we know, Mardi Gras is French for Fat Tuesday, and I hear you're also planning to eat really good today. What are you making?
Oh, yes. Well, we are getting fried chicken and gumbo. Fried chicken is really an iconic Mardi Gras food because people buy it from Popeyes and take it to the parades. And so we are getting it from Dookie Chase Restaurant, which is one of the famous restaurants here. And they're open today, which they normally would not be. And we're getting some of their Creole gumbo and some potato salad.
Well, you know, as I mentioned, more than a million people travel to New Orleans each year to celebrate. This year, most of us are celebrating at home, and obviously, you've gotten your setup down. Let's talk about a few ways that we can celebrate ourselves at home, and let's start with food. I mean, Popeyes is one. We all have a Popeyes somewhere. Yes. What are some other dishes that we can actually make at home?
Well, jambalaya and gumbo are things that people traditionally have here at house parties. You can make the Creole version with tomatoes, or you can make the Cajun version that's brown and use the fond, and you can use practically any protein that you happen to have around. So you can put a lot of vegetables in it. Of course, you put in the Holy Trinity, onion, celery, bell pepper. So jambalaya is a good choice. Gumbo, if you're feeling ambitious, perfect cold weather food.
Mm. What about decorations? What I'm hearing from you is like the more creative, the better.
Well, purple, green, and gold. The blingier, the better. Lots of glitter. Yeah,
the blingier, the better. Love it. Well, tomorrow will be Ash Wednesday, which, of course, is the start of the six-week-long season of Lent leading up to Easter. It is a time of reflection as well. What will you be reflecting on this year?
Maybe all the losses from last year and how that's had to make us stronger. You know, it has had to make us cherish each day. And hopefully, hope is on the horizon. So, you know, with the vaccines, more and more people I know are getting vaccinated. So we can have real Mardi Gras next year.
Real Mardi Gras next year. In the meantime, thank you so much for sharing what you all are doing this year and some tips for us to celebrate it at home as well. Judy Walker is a retired food editor for the Times-Picayune and a freelance columnist for The Advocate. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya. It was great to talk to you. Happy Mardi Gras again to you and all your listeners.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.